Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the July 5th / July 12th, 2024 issue of the Week. And we are in our second show from this double summer issue where the Week publishers are taking a week off. Did a lot of the usuals last week. We'll pick up some new stuff this week, and we'll actually start with the briefing. An American crusade. Christian nationalists have growing political power and believe they are waging a battle for the country's soul. Christian nationalists, what is Christian nationalism? The ideology has no manifesto or single definition, but at its core is the belief that America was founded as a Christian nation and that our laws should be predicated on Christian values. While separation of church and state is thought by many Americans, Christian and non-Christian, religious and secular, to be a bedrock principle of the U.S., Christian nationalists reject the idea that this was the founders' intention. The movement's most extreme believers adhere to dominionism, the belief that Christians are ordained by God to exercise dominion over all aspects of society. Americans who hold such views are a distinct minority. A Public Religion Research Institute, PRRI, survey last year found that 3 in 10 Americans qualify as Christian nationalist adherents, 10%, or sympathizers, 20%. But the political influence of this ideology is growing within the Republican Party and around its presidential nominee, Donald Trump. Christian nationalists believe that this country was founded for Christians like them, generally natural-born citizens and white, said sociologist Andrew L. Whitehead, co-author of Taking America Back for God, which lawmakers have ties to the ideology. House Speaker Mike Johnson, the Republican from Louisiana, is the embodiment of white Christian nationalism in a tailored suit, said Robert Jones, president of PRRI. Johnson has called America a biblical republic and railed against earnest advocates of atheism and sexual perversion. He also has strong connections to the New Apostolic Reformation, a group whose followers believe they are called by God to seize the reins of the federal government and the media. Since becoming speaker, Johnson has been close-lipped about Christian nationalism, but a number of congressional Republicans have not. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, the Republican from Georgia, has called herself a proud Christian nationalist. Representative Paul Gosar, Republican from Arizona, has vowed to take back our country from those intent on making us a godless nation. At a state level, a growing number of legislators have ties to the National Association of Christian Lawmakers, the NACL, formed in 2020 to promote biblical legislation. What do they want? The NACL, which has a Crusader's Shield as a logo and members in 31 state legislatures, has promoted state anti-abortion measures, bills to mandate that public buildings display "In God We Trust," and efforts to fight what founder Jason Rappert calls radical LGBTQ indoctrination in our public schools. Rappert, a former Arkansas state senator, believes Satan and his forces have put a target on America and that the nation is struggling because Christians have failed to take authority. Russell Vaught, a self-proclaimed Christian nationalist who headed the Office of Management and Budget under Trump and is planning for a second Trump administration, has suggested that only migrants who have accepted Israel's God, laws, and understanding of history should be allowed into the U.S. But he accuses critics of scaremongering about Christian nationalism, saying the ideology is committed to an institutional separation between church and state, but not the separation of Christianity from its influence on government and society. Making public policy decisions that are influenced by Christianity, Vaught says, can result in beneficial outcomes for individuals of all faiths. When did this ideology emerge? A belief in the primacy of Christianity goes back to the first European settlers who came to the U.S., and Christian nationalists have long been a voice in the mix among conservatives. But the ideology took a leap forward with the 2016 election of President Donald Trump. Many evangelicals voted for Trump in the belief that he would remake America as a Christian nation, support that was repaid in part by his nomination of three Supreme Court justices who helped topple Roe v. Wade. And Trump's us-against-them mentality rings true to some white Christians who feel threatened by demographic and religious shifts. White people will be a technical minority in the U.S. in about two decades, while church membership among U.S. adults is now below 50%, down from 70% in 2000. Trump, a thrice-married adulterer, may make an unlikely savior in the fight against the godless left, said journalist Tim Alberta, the son of an evangelical pastor. But if you believe the barbarians are at the gate, you might just be willing to turn to a barbarian to do your fighting for you. The influence of Christian nationalism on some of Trump's most fervent supporters was clear during the U.S. Capitol insurrection of January 6, 2021. How was that influence apparent? Many who stormed the Capitol prayed for victory in Jesus' name, waved flags reading, "Jesus is my Savior and Trump is my President," and read biblical passages. While the event served as something of a coming-out party for Trump's Christian nationalist allies, who saw Satan's hand behind the stealing of the election, it also broadened the philosophy's reach. In the wake of January 6, far-right militias and other extremist groups have increasingly embraced religiosity. Expert observers of Christian nationalism say the violent effort that day to overturn democracy is a marker of things to come. When you are on God's side fighting Satan, said Julie Ingersoll, professor of religious studies at the University of North Florida, the niceties of democracy fall by the wayside. Trump's religious agenda. Campaigning for the presidency in 2016, Donald Trump made a vow. If he were elected, Christianity will have power. Now Christian nationalist allies are angling to make that power unprecedented in a second Trump term. Chief among them is Russell Vaught, who served as budget director in the Trump administration. Vaught, who's said America should be recognized as a Christian nation, where our rights and duties are understood to come from God, hopes to use his leverage to elevate Christian nationalism as a focal point in a second Trump term, reported Politico, citing inside sources. He is advising Project 2025, the second-term blueprint being drawn up by conservative groups, whose manifesto states that freedom is defined by God, not man. His own think tank, the Center for Renewing America, has drafted a document bullet-pointing Christian nationalism as a second-term priority. Meanwhile, Trump has echoed the Christian nationalist view that Christianity is under attack, sharing a video on social media that declared he was sent by God to be his caretaker on earth. "I know what's happening," he told a Southern Baptist group in early June, "and I'll be with you side by side." And we'll read a few of the columns that we didn't get to last week. First from the U.S., the era of bipartisan pessimism. Both sides in America's ideological war agree on one striking point, said David Lauder. They think their side is losing. Republicans have embraced Donald Trump because of their frustration over cultural change promoted by a dominant liberal elite and have adopted his apocalyptic tone about crime, migrants, and moral decline. Two-thirds of Republicans said in a poll last year they believe that America's best days are now behind us. Trump's rise has left Democrats no less apoplectic, and they see existential threats in his white nativism and threats to democracy, as well as in climate change. They also feel largely powerless to stop the rightward swing of the country engineered by a 6-3 conservative Supreme Court. Such bipartisan pessimism is unusual in U.S. history. In most elections, one party occupies the high ground of optimism. During the Depression, for example, Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal won over voters by promising a path toward better times. John F. Kennedy, Ronald Reagan, and Barack Obama also inspired voters to believe in a better future. This year, however, both Trump and President Biden are warning that the sky will imminently fall. No wonder that voters find such campaigns dispiriting. This column comes from the EU. Will new biodiversity law green the continent? After months of protest by farmers, the EU has finally managed to pass a landmark law protecting biodiversity across the continent, said Giacomo Calignani in La Repubblica. The nature restoration law requires EU countries to restore at least 20% of degraded land and marine areas by 2030 and nearly all the rest by 2050. The need is dire. The vast majority of European wetlands, grasslands, forests, rivers, and lakes have been ravaged by fertilizer runoff, climate change, and human development. Not only are thousands of animal species at risk, but so is our own access to safe food and water. Restoring our habitats to health will help the continent store carbon, slow global warming, and mitigate the effects of acute disasters like flooding and wildfires. Of course, there was intense opposition to the law by the agricultural industry. Protesting farmers blocked roads with tractors in Poland, dumped crops onto highways in France, and sprayed police with liquid manure in Belgium. Member states' fears of alienating such a key voting bloc meant that the final text came out watered down. Still, even in its milder form, the new law is a historic step forward for the environment. It's a miracle that it passed at all, said Louise Guillot in Politico. The bill, part of the 2020 European Green Deal, had been haggled over for years, and a compromise had supposedly been reached. But with the ascent of the right in European politics over the past few months, as right-wing and far-right parties notched unprecedented numbers in European Parliament elections, it suddenly looked as though it would fail by just one vote. It was only saved at the last minute by a rogue Austrian minister willing to throw away her job, get sued by her own government, and potentially tank her entire coalition. Austrian Environment Minister Leonor Gewessler, a member of the Green Party, was under orders to vote no, but decided at the 11th hour that it was her duty to save the planet. Defying her government, she backed the bill and pushed it through. It was a remarkable moment and a portent. From here on, environmental regulation in Europe will be knockdown, drag-out fights. Gewessler now faces legal jeopardy in Austria, said Axel Bojanowski in Die Welt. And for what? This law is unlikely to create the utopia of biodiversity it promises. Its rigid specifications and quotas ignore the geographic variation across European countries. In Germany, for example, the countryside has been cultivated for centuries. Where's the supposed wilderness we're meant to restore? Brussels has merely dumped more paperwork onto our officials' already cluttered desks. Bureaucracy will thrive, biodiversity won't. In fact, many countries may be able to get by doing relatively little, said Matthias Auer in Die Presse. The new law requires each country to decide on its own how much degraded land it has and what it will take to restore it. Like other parts of the European Green Deal, there's no outside body providing oversight. Austria, for example, could count many of its existing remediation measures toward its quota and come out ahead. So, will this measure really save the planet? Ask us again in 2050. And this column is from New Zealand. Redneck vengeance on wayward kids. Military-style boot camps for juvenile delinquents don't work, said Martin Bradbury. You know it, I know it, and the national party that came up with the idea knows it. First instituted in the 1980s and 90s, boot camps were a resounding failure. Fully 94% of New Zealand teenagers sentenced to such corrective training reoffended within 5 years, a recidivism rate far worse than that of general juvenile jail population. Boot camps flopped a second time when the Nats tried them again in 2010 with 83% recidivism. And now yet another National Party government is pitching military camps to crack down on serious youth offenders. The plan is to make teens convicted of assault or robbery run fitness drills as military veterans bark orders at them. Those who work with such kids know they don't need harsh discipline. Most are already victims of trauma. Subjecting them to more abuse does nothing to teach them impulse control and emotional regulation. It only hardens their anti-authority attitudes. But this government doesn't care about scientific evidence. It knows voters just want revenge, and a sense these kids will be frightened and yelled at. Boot camps are nothing but redneck vengeance being passed off as social policy. And here's the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, A Song for El Chapo. A young lawyer found a job on the defense team of Mexico's most notorious cartel boss, said Kate Linthicum in the Los Angeles Times. The trial would launch a very unusual singing career. Mariel Colon had just finished law school and was waiting for the results of the bar exam when she replied to a Craigslist ad looking for a Spanish-speaking paralegal to help with translation on a major case. Only later did she learn that she'd been working on one of the biggest trials of the decade, helping defend the notorious Sinaloa drug cartel chief Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. The inmate Colon encountered, deep in the bowels of a Manhattan prison, seemed hungry for human connection after years of isolation in jail. So as Colon explained to Guzman what the attorneys on his drug trafficking and murder conspiracy case were planning, she looked for ways to bond. I told him I love singing, she said, and he told me he loves music. Colon learned his favorite songs, banda and ranchera classics, and serenaded him there in the jailhouse. He applauded. She credits Guzman with rekindling her love of performing and sparking her interest in the rich tradition of Mexican country music. And so, as her legal career blossomed and she carved out an expertise representing drug traffickers like El Chapo, She also pursued an unlikely side hustle as a swaggering singer of corridos under the stage name La Abogada, the lawyer. On a recent sweltering weekend at a Tracy, California festival billed as Coachella, a ranchera music, young couples in jeans and boots spun around in the dirt as all-male bands from both sides of the border swigged tequila from the bottle and played boisterous songs about epic parties, grievous infidelities, and the daring lives of drug traffickers. Backstage on a tour bus whose windows looked out at acres of California almond groves, Colon waited nervously to perform. She wore a Merlot-colored cowboy hat, fresh out of the box, and matching boots whose heels lifted her just above 5 feet. In the testosterone-heavy world of regional Mexican music, the 33-year-old Puerto Rican singer knew she was a bit out of place. "I'm female," she said, "and I'm not Mexican." But she had one thing going for her that none of the other bands could claim: a close bond with the man lionized in many of the narco corridos the musicians were belting on stage. Colon, who today is Guzman's primary lawyer, is one of the few people permitted to visit him in the Colorado Supermax prison where he is serving a life sentence. And while the details of their semi-monthly meetings never make it into her songs, attorney-client privilege, she explains, her proximity to Mexico's most notorious cartel boss is an undeniable selling point in a culture obsessed with all things narco. She has leaned heavily into the lawyer persona. In her first music video, filmed in a courtroom, she wore a hot pink pantsuit and crooned, "Good morning, Judge. Please give me the floor. I have come to defend a broken heart." It was a bit gimmicky, sure, and as a woman of the famously machista industry of Mexican regional music, Colon felt the odds were stacked against her. But she was banking on the undeniable force of her singing voice, the public's everlasting obsession with Guzman, and her own tenacity. "If I made it on the Chapo case, I'm going to make it here," she said. Then she stepped from her tour bus and strode with her band onto the stage. Before Colon was a lawyer, she was a musician. She grew up around salsa, merengue, and pop in Puerto Rico, where her father was a percussionist and band leader. She begged her parents for voice lessons and took any opportunity to perform, dancing alongside her dad's bands on stage and dressing up as a clown for her parents' kid party business. Colon dreamed of fame as a singer, but her family, aware of the challenges of the music industry, pushed her to take a more conventional path. She studied music business at Loyola University in New Orleans and law at Hofstra University in New York. She planned at first to be an entertainment lawyer, but found herself drawn to the courtroom drama of criminal cases. "Criminal law is exactly like performing," she said. "Your audience is the judge and jury. You have a storyline, and you have to convince them of it." She met Guzman in 2018. Known as El Chapo, or Shorty, because of his height, he had been extradited to the U.S. to face trial after twice escaping prison in Mexico. Back home, Guzman was often viewed as a folk hero, a rags-to-riches country kid from the Sinaloa Sierra, known for his generosity with locals and his keen ability to evade authorities. But prosecutors accused him of fueling an addiction crisis in the U.S. and ruthlessly torturing and killing competitors. During his trial, they shared evidence that Guzman had burned the bodies of rivals and once ordered a man to be killed after he refused to shake the cartel boss's hand. Colon knew little about Guzman when she first met him inside the cement fortress, that is, Manhattan's Metropolitan Correctional Center. In between translations of plans for opening statements and cross-examinations, they talked about their shared love of music. Guzman was a devotee of Mexican regional music, an umbrella term that refers to the subgenres of country popular in different parts of Mexico. Colon, who knew little about the style, researched his favorite bands and singers, including Jenny Rivera and Los Tucanes de Tijuana, and she went about teaching him tunes from contemporary musicians like Peso Pluma, a more contemporary singer who sings frequently about El Chapo, and who was recently threatened by a rival cartel for his perceived sympathies to Sinaloa. She loved the way the regional songs were composed and the intensity of the lyrics. "I'm very dramatic and very passionate," she said. "I mean, it was just perfect for me." When Colon was admitted to the bar in late 2018, Guzman asked if she would join his defense team as a trial attorney. His more experienced lawyers shaped most of the strategy, but once the tribunal began, Colon often found herself in the spotlight, giving interviews to Spanish-language journalists and gaining tens of thousands of followers on Instagram, where she posted courtroom sketches of herself and content praising Guzman's wife, a former beauty queen named Emma Coronel, who had become a close friend. Guzman was eventually convicted of smuggling massive amounts of narcotics into the U.S. during the decades he led the brutal Sinaloa cartel. Although the defense team had lost the case, the phone in Colon's Brooklyn law office kept ringing. It turned out that many accused drug traffickers, even those from rival cartels, wanted the chance to work with El Chapo's attorney. Colon also briefly worked on the case of sex offender and sex trafficking defendant Jeffrey Epstein before he committed suicide. Colon loved to work. A devout Christian, she had no qualms about representing people accused of heinous crimes. She said her religion taught her not to judge others. She liked advocating for clients such as Guzman, whose isolation in the Colorado prison she has repeatedly argued is inhumane. But she still felt a calling to music, and specifically wanted to explore the genre Guzman had turned her onto. She asked her clients what they thought about her launching a music career. Colon said they all gave her their blessing. "They know I'm always singing," she said, "and they're the only ones who should have a say, because they're the ones paying me." Colon says one of her biggest supporters was Coronel, 34, who served 2 years in prison after pleading guilty to helping run her husband's drug empire. Days after Coronel was freed last fall, she was spotted sipping cocktails in the VIP section of a Linwood, California nightclub where Colon was performing. The headlines that followed brought new attention to Colon's singing career. "I didn't want it to be a PR stunt," Colon said of Coronel's visit. "I just wanted my friend, who had just gotten out of prison, to see me perform because she's always been very supportive of me." Every 2 weeks, Colon flies into Colorado Springs and drives 40 miles to one of the country's most intensely guarded prisons. There she spends 4 or 5 hours with Guzman, who spends 23 hours a day locked in a 7-by-12-foot cell. Guzman has almost no contact with the outside world. Not even his wife is allowed to visit him. Guzman and Colon talk legal matters, yes, but also personal things, ranging from stories about their childhoods to Colon's love life. "He knows a lot about me, and I know a lot about him," she said. She admits that some of the anecdotes he has shared would make for great lyrics, but Colon says she draws a clear boundary between her two careers. "I have to be real careful about what I sing about," she said. Just before Colon took stage at the festival in Tracy, a video played on a massive screen. It showed clips of her getting out of a car in a slick pantsuit, taking tequila shots with a group of friends, and in a hot tub surrounded by candles. A picture of a young Guzman flashed. "Many know her as the lawyer of El Chapo," a male voice intoned. Colon, who only started releasing music last year and is still at work on her first EP, was one of the lesser-known names to play at the festival. As she took the stage, the response from the crowd was lukewarm at first. But as she started singing, first a song by Rivera, later a cover of a corrido about El Chapo, "The Earth Turns and Stops If Joaquin Orders It," the crowd warmed up. Women, in particular, seemed excited by her presence in the otherwise all-male lineup. After she finished throwing black-dyed roses into the crowd, she stepped off stage and got a hug from Arturo Hernandez, a gray-haired man in a Santa Clara Law sweatshirt. Hernandez, an attorney who has represented many cartel members, met Colon during the Guzman trial when she asked him for information on Sinaloa. He saw in her parallels with his own career and took her under his wing. In the 1980s, he was a young attorney just starting out when he represented serial killer Richard Ramirez, known as the Night Stalker. Hernandez had advised her on how to handle the media. He supported her, too, when she told him she wanted to be a singer. His advice both times was the same. "Have fun," he said. "Enjoy the ride." She is enjoying it. Even so, the demands of the music industry, which requires artists to also be influencers, can be a lot. Some people have asked what will happen to her legal career if music takes off. If that happens, she knows she might have to reduce her caseload. But she said she'll forever be loyal to El Chapo. "I have a responsibility to make sure that he has the best quality of life, whether it be inside or outside, and especially if it's inside," she said. She feels the same way about Coronel, whom she is advising on several potential business ventures. "They gave me my first opportunity," she said. "I'd cancel concerts for them." As the sun sank over California farm country, the young crowd outside kept dancing and drinking, and Colon and her team prepared to head out. She had some recording in San Francisco to do, some cases to work on, and a few days later, a trip to Colorado to make. This story originally appeared in the Los Angeles Times. And we'll spend a little time on the business page this week. They call it the news at a glance. Competition. EU brings charges against Apple. The European Union is laying down the law on big tech, said Javier Espinoza in the Financial Times. European regulators accused Apple this week of stifling competition, which could carry fines of up to 10% of its annual revenue, close to $40 billion. The regulators accused Apple of breaking the EU's new gatekeeper rules, the Digital Markets Act, by infringing on developers' right to freely steer their customers to apps outside the company's app store. A day later, Brussels hit Microsoft with an antitrust charges over its video conferencing software. For its part, Apple says EU regulation will halt innovation and announced it would delay artificial intelligence-enabled features on iPhones in the EU. "It feels like we're in the early stages of a second Hundred Years' War," said Martin Pierce in the information. "Instead of England and France, it's U.S. tech firms against the European Commission." It makes sense that Apple is the first to get collared under Europe's tightened restrictions. As soon as the DMA launched, the company brazenly instituted new fees to effectively replace the old developer fees that brought their original antitrust complaints against it in the first place. Apple will fight for its bottom line as long as it can, but European regulators see this war as their raison d'etre. Boeing prosecutors push to reopen 737 MAX case. Prosecutors this week urged the Justice Department to bring criminal charges against Boeing over the two crashes of its 737 MAX, said Chris Isidore and Evan Perez in CNN.com. Although top DOJ officials haven't made a final decision, Boeing reached a deferred prosecution agreement in January 2021 to settle charges that allege the company defrauded the Federal Aviation Administration during the certification process of the 737 MAX. But in May, Justice Department officials said Boeing violated the agreement by failing to uphold its compliance pledge, reopening the door to potential criminal liability. Trade. Houthi attacks raise worldwide shipping rates. The average global cost of shipping a cargo container this month was more than triple the cost a year ago, as the effects of conflict in the Middle East ripple through the global economy, said Paul Berger and Costas Paris in the Wall Street Journal. The Suez Canal has been effectively closed since last year after a spate of Houthi rebel attacks on commercial ships following the outbreak of war in Gaza. The Panama Canal has also been limiting ship movements because of a drought. The disruptions have led to gridlock at ports and other logistical headaches that recall the supply chain failures of the pandemic. EVs. Volkswagen to back Rivian with investment deal. Rivian shares jumped this week after the company got a $1 billion investment from Volkswagen, said Jack Ewing in the New York Times. The deal, which begins with a $1 billion investment but could reach up to $5 billion, represents a big vote of confidence for Rivian, which has strained to meet expectations. Though its electric trucks have received glowing reviews, the company still loses tens of thousands of dollars on each vehicle it sells. The cash infusion will help Rivian, while Volkswagen gets software expertise that it sorely lacks. Firms start to cool on hot desks. Employers are luring workers back to the office with a more traditional perk, said Matthew Boyle in Bloomberg, their own desk. Hot desking or hoteling, where workers share a communal array of workstations, took off during the pandemic as companies downsized their office footprint. The problems with the musical chairs of hot desking on a busy weekday have given employees more reasons to stay home. Office architect Gensler said that 17% of workplace seating in the U.S. is now unassigned, compared with 19% in 2022. The preference for a dedicated office space isn't just about having a place to display family photos. With hot desking, said one commentator on Reddit, I spend 30 minutes in my morning readjusting the chair position and screen height. And a few of the short business notes. They call it the bottom line. The median price of an existing U.S. home climbed for the 11th consecutive month in May, up 5.8% from a year ago to $419,300, the highest ever recorded by the National Association of Realtors. Solar panels this year will provide the world with about 6% of its electricity, which is almost three times as much electrical energy as America consumed back in 1954. Ferrari's first electric car will cost at least 500,000 euros, $535,000, when it launches next year. The price tag, which doesn't include features and personal touches that typically add 15 to 20%, is well above Ferrari's current average sale price of around $375,000, including extras. The technology and health and science pages are side by side in the magazine, so we'll take a sampling of each. Starting with flying eyes, U.S. may ban top-selling drones. The outlook for America's best-selling flying cameras is cloudy at best, said Lance Ulanoff in Tech Radar. The House last week passed a bill, the Countering CCP Drones Act, to bar Chinese-made drones from the U.S. The legislation now goes to the Senate, and from there it could be a short flight to President Biden's desk. The main target is a drone manufactured called Dajiang Innovations, DJI, that dominates the market for hobby drones and those used by first responders. There's a reason for that dominance. Other drones pale in comparison to DJI's flyers. Its products are light, durable, fast, and shockingly easy to fly, even for the novice, which also makes them safer than those of competitors. But that may not matter to lawmakers who are rapidly moving Chinese technology companies from safe and acceptable to dangerous and bannable. That's because Chinese drones really are one of the most significant intelligence and national security threats we currently face, said Rob Joyce in The Hill. The Pentagon has classified Dajiang Innovations as a Chinese military company, and their images are available on demand to Chinese intelligence apparatus. This isn't hyperbole. In 2017, U.S. Customs officials accused DJI of sending data from their bird's-eye views of American infrastructure back to China. All it takes is a few keystrokes to turn a harmless drone into a highly effective espionage device. China's superiority in the drone business isn't accidental, said Thomas Black in Bloomberg. It came with the help of government subsidies that enabled Chinese drones to flood the global market and decimated U.S. small drone makers. Now we are seeing the ramifications. Soldiers on both sides of the war in Ukraine are deploying thousands of Chinese drones, which are used both as reconnaissance and weapons. It should be a wake-up call on the dangers of letting an unfriendly nation dominate the drone market. The way we got to this proposed ban tells us what a mess U.S. technology policy has become, said Jason Kobler in 404 Media. When drones first became popular, people flew them over baseball stadiums, near airports, above wildfires, and active crime scenes. For safety reasons, the U.S. insisted on a series of features and restrictions, like GPS tracking and geofencing, to bar drones from some areas. All of this did make drones safer and more useful. Now, though, these tracking and mapping features are being held up as the main threat vector through which China could theoretically spy on DJI users. Meanwhile, ironically, a real privacy threat to Americans may well be increasing use of drones by police to continuously surveil American neighborhoods. One area in which American drone company Skydio is the key player. The first AI job casualties. AI is already taking the place of contract work, said Christopher Mims in the Wall Street Journal. Freelance jobs, particularly those that require basic writing, coding, or translation, are disappearing across postings on job boards like Upwork, Fiverr, and other platforms. Researchers believe the culprit is artificial intelligence. The first job losses are in areas particularly susceptible to automation, researchers say. But worry is rising across social media and in the whisper networks that freelancers rely on for business. Reed Southern, a concept artist for TV and movies, said he's lost half of his income because show producers are using Midjourney AI for the sketches used to map out shows. One silver lining is that sometimes the AI work turns out to be so bad that freelancers are getting hired to clean up the computer's mess. A star that zooms alone through space. Amateur astronomers have discovered a rogue star hurtling through our galaxy at a breakneck speed. J1249+36 is a hypervelocity star that has been observed traveling 1.3 million miles per hour, fast enough to potentially escape the Milky Way. Astrophysicist Adam Bergasser tells Space.com. After citizen volunteers spotted the interstellar sprinter, Bergasser of the University of California, San Diego, and his team of researchers used the W.M. Keck Observatory in Hawaii to measure its infrared spectrum. They determined that J129 plus 36 belongs to the rare L subdwarf class of stars, some of the oldest in the galaxy, and distinctive for their relatively light mass and cool temperature. But why is it streaking across the galaxy? The team has three theories. It may have once been paired with another star that went supernova, launching its neighbor like a rocket. It might have once belonged to a globular cluster centered around a pair of black holes, which can forcefully eject stars that get too close to them. Or it could be a foreign interloper spun off of one of the nearby dwarf galaxies orbiting the Milky Way. To figure out which theory is correct, researchers will next attempt to measure the chemical composition of J129 1249 plus 36. We're essentially looking for a chemical fingerprint, says University of Notre Dame physics and astronomy fellow Roman Gerasimov, a study co-author, that would pinpoint what system this star is from. Thinking without words. We don't need language to reason. That's the conclusion of a 15-year study that may overturn a decades-old belief that cognition depends on language processing, reports the New York Times. Evelina Fedorenko, a neuroscientist who led this study, first heard the theory at MIT from linguist Noam Chomsky, who argued that language is required for thought and intrinsic to human brains. Intrigued, Fedorenko focused her research on determining exactly how the brain produces language. She had volunteers perform cognitive and linguistic tasks, while researchers took ultra-detailed images of their brains. Certain areas of the brain lit up during language processing tasks, such as reading, but those areas did not activate when the volunteers performed cognitive tests, like solving puzzles or doing math. None of those things seem to engage language circuits, Fedorenko says. If language is necessary for communication but not for thinking, it may explain why some stroke sufferers who lost the power of speech can still play chess and do algebra. And it may also shed light on why AI models based on language are good at writing but terrible at logic. Plummeting prices for used EVs. For the first time, used EVs are cheaper than their traditional gas counterparts, said Philip DeMott in Business Insider. It's a staggering turn of events from a year ago and a bad sign for the companies that have bet on a coming wave of demand for EVs. Last year, used EVs cost 25% more on average than used gas cars. In one example, a used Tesla Model 3 for sale cost $2,635 more in June 2023 than a comparable BMW 3 Series, but it stood $4,806 below the BMW in May 2024. Even more buyers are gravitating toward hybrid models. In a June AAA survey, only 18% of consumers indicated they would be likely to purchase an EV, compared with a third of respondents saying they'd want a hybrid. And we'll finish, as we often do, on the Talking Points page. I think we can get the last two articles here. U.S. edition, a very British scandal. The reporter should never become the story, and neither should the newspaper's boss, said Jack Schaefer in Politico. Yet Washington Post publisher William Lewis, a product of the UK's cutthroat newspaper culture, has failed to hold back the surging tide of exposés that last week drove away his handpicked choice for editor-in-chief, Robert Winnett of The Telegraph. When they worked for London broadsheets, Lewis and Winnett at various points stole phone records, had a reporter get a government job to access sensitive documents, and paid a source $120,000 in connection with a 2009 investigation of corruption in Parliament. Can this be attributed to a culture clash between Lewis' hard-edged Fleet Street nature and American journalist? Maybe. But since such methods violate long-standing ethical codes at the Post and other U.S. newspapers, his credibility and his job are on the line. There's a reason Post owner Jeff Bezos is poaching talent from the U.K., said Fraser Nelson in The Spectator. Our journalism tends to be profitable because our journalists put getting the story first. The Telegraph turned a $76 million profit last year, while the Post lost $77 million. Yes, Lewis alienated many underlings when he told them bluntly that people aren't reading the paper. But something needs to change at the Post. Since its degeneration into an anti-Trump political project, its audience has halved. Winnett, who is now staying put at the Telegraph, was Bezos' best chance to set things right. None of the Gen Z crocodiles out for blood in Lewis' newsroom seemed to realize that Bezos could simply shut the whole thing down, said Matthew Hennessy in the Wall Street Journal. He must be getting tired of eight-figure losses and constant insubordination, and there's nothing in the Constitution that says we need a Washington Post. But what Lewis and Winnett did is no small matter, said Stephanie McCrumman in The Atlantic. When my former Post colleagues and I reported on U.S. Senate candidate Roy Moore's repeated pursuit of teenage girls in 2017, Moore's allies tried to discredit us by claiming that we were paying sources. We were able to counter the lies because serious U.S. journalists have always made clear to readers that we do not pay sources, much less steal documents, hack computers, or indulge in the kinds of reckless deception that have been common in British journalism. It's not self-importance. It's a matter of survival. Judge Cannon, slow-walking a Trump trial. The federal judge overseeing Donald Trump's classified document case could be in over her head, in the tank for Trump, or both, said Charlie Savage and Alan Foyer in the New York Times. When the case was randomly assigned to Judge Aileen Cannon, two senior judges urged the relatively inexperienced Trump appointee to pass it on to another judge, especially after an appeals court had reversed and sharply criticized her initial order to keep prosecutors from seeing documents seized at Mar-a-Lago. But Cannon kept the case and even gave up another to clear her calendar. More recently, Cannon's handling of the case has become under intensifying scrutiny as she has indefinitely postponed the trial to hold hearings on far-fetched motions from Trump's attorneys, including their claim that appointment and funding of Special Counsel Jack Smith is unconstitutional, a question courts have repeatedly settled in previous special counsel cases. Already facing criticism, she's in the tank for Trump. A testy Cannon really went after the prosecution this week, said Justin Rohrlich in the Daily Beast. The government asked for a gag order on Trump, arguing that his absurd claims about FBI agents being locked and loaded and given the green light to assassinate him during their Mar-a-Lago search could lead to violence. When a prosecutor suggested that Cannon was not adequately protecting FBI agents from terrible things, she said, "I don't appreciate your tone." Actually, Cannon is right to fully air difficult issues with this case before the trial begins, said William McGurn in the Wall Street Journal. She is being vilified by Trump haters only because, like Smith, they are desperate for the case to go to trial before the election. Cannon has proved she has no business presiding over the case, said David A. Graham in The Atlantic. Trump's willful mishandling of the nation's most sensitive secrets and his defiance of a subpoena to turn them over is a very serious charge, and the trial should be straightforward. Instead, the case is crawling forward, and Cannon's bizarre rulings in favor of the man who gave her a lifetime appointment strongly suggest sabotage. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court has successfully delayed Trump's January 6th trial by taking months to weigh his claim of total immunity to prosecution. That means voters are unlikely to get jury verdicts on the most serious charges against Trump before they cast ballots. In the short notes, Melania Trump has not appeared at any of her husband's campaign events in recent months, nor did she appear with him in court during his seven-week hush money trial in New York, or even at Trump's fundraiser 78th birthday party. 15 people who've recently spent time at Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate were asked whether they'd seen Melania recently, and none had. And we'll finish the show today with a couple of quotes. H.G. Wells says, "Moral indignation is jealousy with a halo." And Arthur Ashe says, "Start where you are, use what you have, do what you can." Good advice. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, if you have comments or questions, give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.